What if incident management software in 10 years' time is doing the equivalent to generalized running software as Kubernetes is doing to running containers on nodes? And in that world, you essentially go, I have this machine that can sort of take control of a bunch of different operational activities for me, and I trust it to do them all. And if it breaks, I'm going to need humans. And I think humans will always be necessary, because
Yes.
if you sort of buy into the fact that incidents are fundamentally what happens when all of the planned controls, all of the work that you've thought about ahead of time have failed, then you
Yes.
will always hit that limit, and it will just be a different level of abstraction that we get.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we improve production by challenging the status quo. Your host, Armin Astani from Certo Modo.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check.
Reliability Rebels.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we explore how to make software and systems more reliable by challenging the status quo. I'm your host, Amin Astani. So, software. It automates away the messy manual work we humans used to do by hand. It's consistent, it's scalable, always on, so long as we build it well enough. But traditional software always demanded something unnatural from us, that we speak in code. But today, with AI, we're flipping that on its head. We're asking computers to understand us in our own language. In SRE, IT, DevOps, and platform engineering, we also want to automate our own work, eliminate the repetitive tasks, stop doing all the boring stuff, free us engineers to focus on everything else. AI, of course, it's a new tool, help us accomplish this goal. But here's the big question. Is automating our work in this way always the right approach? Or are there trade-offs we're not seeing? To explore this, we're joined by Chris Evans, co-founder, chief product officer of Incident.io. We met at their inaugural SevZero conference last year, had a great conversation about production incidents, of course, but also the limits of automation and the unavoidable hype around AI, especially after he published a pretty interesting article on the subject. Chris, welcome to the show.
Absolute pleasure to be here. What a great intro as well. Love it.
Thank you. I took some time to prepare, of course. So I've been following your recent adventures. You've been migrating yourself and your family from the UK across the pond to San Francisco. You're still getting work done. And then you're also squeezing in coding from time to time. How are you doing, man? You must be tired.
Yeah, I guess, yes. I think I've been tired for about 4 years now, starting this company. It's all sort of just different versions of tired. And then before that, having kids, it was a different version of being tired. But yeah, there's a lot going on in my life at the minute. So as you say, moving from London, where I've been based my whole sort of working career, to San Francisco, sort of scaling up our office and presence over there, which is an incredibly exciting move, but also an enormous move, especially with two kids and a wife to sort of bring along as well. But super excited to do it. It's going to be great. And then on the coding front, yes, this is, I mean, we can probably get into this at great depth, but like sort of dusting off my coding boots recently, you know, following on the hype of all the kind of Claude Code and cursors, you know, of the world and stuff. And so, yeah, I've actually been shipping stuff to the production that I have been sort of mostly coding through those kinds of tools, which has just been an incredibly interesting experience. But yeah, it's a busy time for sure.
Fantastic. Good to see that you're still on the horse, even though you're on the product side of things. And yeah, being busy, being tired. Yeah, but you're doing all of the fulfilling stuff, starting a family, building a business. So good on you.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's listen, it's all life is full of different stresses, and it's like this is a good time in my life, I think, despite it being also a very stressful one.
Yeah, amazing attitude. So let's take a step back. In case listeners aren't aware, tell us a little bit about Incident.io. What is it? What does it do? What problems does it solve?
Yeah, so I guess like Incident.io was born in its conception at the company that I worked at previously, before starting this company, a company here in London called Monzo. So Monzo is essentially like a neobank. It's like, I mean, it was like, and still is like a phenomenal tech company here in London. Like, you know, it's now has, I think, over 10 million customers. It's like a serious bank here. And when I joined it, it was the early days of being a serious bank. And when I joined, I was responsible for running the platform team and I took on responsibility of running OnCall. And OnCall was a pretty painful experience. And they were dealing with incidents where these incidents were like not just technical things, but being a regulated bank, it was like, you know, you had regulators to worry about and you had many hundreds of thousands at the time of customers to worry about. And then you had like MasterCard, like payment schemes who were also involved. And so these incidents were like really, really complex. And so I ended up writing like a laughably simple piece of software at the time that sort of evolved over my time at Monzo, which was just sort of like, you know, after the bit where PagerDuty pages you, you know, how do you actually run that process more effectively and sort of easily? So everything running from inside Slack, because that's where everyone was working. So don't make people like flip between tabs of their browser. And then a whole bunch of other little workflows on top of that. And that was sort of where Incident.io started its life, sort of that incident response part. So after you've been paged, how do you make sure that process sort of is efficient, easy, low cognitive load for people? We then have since now broadened out. So we now do the paging side of things. So we have an on-call product. We then also do status pages so we can help you communicate with your customers. And then literally sort of a week old at this point in terms of sort of like public launch, we have what we call currently calling AISRE. It will come up with a better name because it's a bit of a mouthful. But essentially, this is the product which is, will help you to actually resolve and sort of debug and understand your sort of production systems and understand how to sort of fix those things when they go wrong. So an incredibly, incredibly exciting time to be building something like that. But that's roughly what Incident.io is. You can think of it as like a full suite of tools to help you manage incidents.
Yeah, that's awesome. So would it be accurate to say that Incident.io's genesis was a rage coding activity? You were frustrated where you were at the moment and you needed to build something?
Yes. I think yes, in sort of the, you know, if we're sort of taking common parlance like rage coding, but it was born of a, like, you know, I had a real desire to make incidents not a really bad thing at the bank. And so I ended up writing it mostly whilst I was watching my kids do their, like, you know, sports lessons or whatever else it was. And so I'd go on a Saturday morning, have a coffee, sat down and just be like, you know, coding away on the side there. So, but yeah, I think in general, it was born out of a kind of like what we saw, what I saw was like just like a big missing part of the picture, which was like no one was really helping me do the bit where it was sort of most, where I spent most of my time in incidents. Like making someone's phone make a noise is important, but not super impactful. So yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, as a person who spent a good part of his career being on call and dealing with the frustrations and the manual tasks, fantastic. Yeah, solves big problems for sure.
Looking to scale your SaaS product or IT department without the usual headaches and costs? Check out Certo Modo's rapid assessment of production in depth. For a flat fee, you will get a personalized, actionable roadmap to make your systems more scalable and reliable, all based on best practices from top tech companies and host Armin Astani's practical experience. Here's a real testimonial from a previous client.
As a technical leader, it's like a tangible document that you can give to an engineering team or a product team and be like, okay, here's the recommendations. Go create the stories, go implement those things. You have that direction. So it's just good knowing that you have that document, you trust the source that it's coming from, and it's the right things to do for your company at this time. And it's not just like, I read this blog article on the internet and it tells me to do this. And no, we vetted it with you, and that's valuable.
You can scale smarter, no extra hires needed. Learn more at certomodo.io. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show.
So, you mentioned prior to building Incident.io, you were at this digital bank, Monzo. And around that time, SRE was starting to take off, right? And back in those days, what did we have to roll at SRE? We had the SRE book. Maybe we had a few articles on the internet. So you had to figure out how to roll out reliability practices. And of course, you're spending a lot of time thinking about it from the incident side. But what did you end up doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I when the SRE book came out, I think like basically every technologist in the sort of vicinity of platform operations, you know, more back end sort of software engineering, read it cover to cover. And I remember getting super hyped about it. I was like, this is the future. Like, it's what Google are doing. We're all going to do it. And I guess I sort of I read it and then I was like, I don't really know how to apply a lot of it. So a lot of it was a bit of a like, a bit of a leap. And I was like, okay, but I'm here. A lot of those things are like many steps removed from the problems that I'm seeing. So that was like one fraction I had on there. I was then actually really fortunate in that I went to Monzo and I can't claim to have sort of invented or brought any of the kind of SRE-ish culture there. I joined, I can't remember, I was like employee 100 or something. Platform team was like four people, but Monzo had hired some phenomenal, like probably the best, one of some of the best engineers I've worked with. And they had started the company sort of in that kind of SRE-ish kind of like ethos of broadly like how do we make sure every problem is a software engineering problem? And so there was, I joined there and they were running, I mean, they were running their own fork of Kubernetes because they had realized there was a bug. They were really early adopters. They'd realized there was a bug in the sort of the common distro and they'd fixed it for the particular use case that they had because they were in the code and sort of fixing things at that level, commit sort of changes back upstream. But generally, that was I think my first exposure of like, okay, no, I get it. This is how things work. And the team there, they're like, the default was if we need to do a thing, it's like, how do we write software that does it? And Monzo was a phenomenal company for writing really atomic microservices. And there's lots of things online, people going absolutely like nuts about like Monzo having too many microservices. They had like thousands of independent services, many replicas of each of those. But it was just a really strong culture, I think, for that sort of like, how do we apply, the software thing to operations. And so everything, even like migrations of code and migrations of like platform components, they were all managed typically by software, which was just, it was just amazing. I think that was probably the sort of the best I've seen it done, I think.
Wow, that's saying something, especially when joining a team of four. I mean, how many customers did you have with that platform team of four? Were you like rapidly growing, rocket ship?
Yeah, I think when I joined, there were some ones that started its life as not as a bank, as a prepaid card. It was like they were sort of in parallel. They launched as a prepaid card and in parallel were getting the banking license, which is a quite a long, drawn out, paperworky process. And I joined just at the tail end of the prepaid card era, which where they had, I think it was about 180,000 customers. So large by sort of like, B2C standards of like, 180,000 customers is not, it's not nothing, right? But it was very efficient. And I think like the team was then able to grow sublinearly with customer growth. So by the time I left, I think there was something like 7 million or something. And the team was still, I think it was like 15, 16, something like that. And it had taken a bunch more responsibility. And I think that was one of the really interesting things for me of like why it was so provably working for how we were doing things, and that we could, orders of magnitude grow the customer base and not even get close to orders of magnitude of the platform thing. It used to be one of the KPIs on my team was what is the per person per year cost of running and supplying the platform, accounting for infrastructure, software, headcount. And that was something that we were KPI'd on. And it was like, keep that lean. And it worked really well. And I think it's a good example of why sort of cranking out more manual effort in response to sort of reliability problems and things and just throwing more people at it is not it's not necessary, is really the thing.
Oh, 100%. You're the first person I've spoken to that actually understands that you want to create a relationship between the number of engineers supporting a production system and the number of customers you're supporting. And you want like a logarithmic relationship where you have hundreds of thousands of customers and a handful of engineers. Like that is the SRE end game. That is the goal, right? From a business standpoint. So it's awesome you explicitly called that out. You have goals set for it. That's really pretty progressive when it comes to like engineering management, in my view.
I think honestly, like I genuinely feel incredibly privileged to have worked at Monzo. It was like some of the best people in my career that I've had the pleasure of working with, and there was just so much learning and sort of doing things in novel and interesting ways that ultimately you can afford to do because you're a company that's been built so quickly and so everything's new, right? You get to define all the things. There's no like, well, we have the legacy system from 10 years ago and that sort of thing. But yeah, that I think that relationship between like how many people does it take to create the value that you need on the other side, and us trying to make that, you know, that really a really big gap. So as fewer people as possible, creating as much value for as many people as possible is a huge thing. And I think that is an incredibly interesting way to think about, like, well, what AI is doing to coding these days. You know, it's like one engineer now can be tackling, like, we have engineers who are literally tackling like four different like bug reports or feature requests in parallel, like with AI, and it's absolutely wild.
Wow. I'm sure. Yeah, we'll definitely be talking more about the role of AI and incident management and operating a production system in a bit. But yeah, it's a good call out. We're getting a lot more leverage bang for our buck with the amount of effort that we're able to place. So of course, working at any company, not every day is a good day. You have struggles too. And of course, our listeners love the occasional war story. So there was a day all the way back in 2019, Monzo had a big production incident. It was really rough. Mind regaling us with this tale of what happened back then?
Yes. I mean, it's a long time ago. I tell you what, I can remember a few things about that. I remember the exact date, which was July 29th, 2019. I remember the incident number. So all our incidents had numbers, and it was incident 763. And it's like ingrained in my mind. It was, I think, the worst incident I was involved in. I should say, like, we had plenty of incidents at Monzo, like most tech companies. This one, the story essentially, in short, was we were doing what was entirely routine sort of database operations for us. And so we ran Cassandra, we ran it as our primary data store, and it was something that we ran directly on EC2. So it was pre AWS having a managed service for Cassandra, which the bank now does run, which is amazing for them. But yeah, we were doing a normal operation of essentially like scaling up this cluster. And so the cluster had, you know, a number of nodes. Essentially over time, it gets more and more full in terms of like storage, and also full in terms of like load. So like Cassandra, essentially you query it, it fans out and it does like quorum reading, quorum writing. And essentially over time, you need to add more nodes to it. Normal thing to do. So we had basically made some changes to how we did do this thing. We'd done all the testing and staging. We'd done, you know, everything that, you know, you would expect from someone doing a database operation for a really, really important piece of infrastructure, for a really important piece of software, the bank. And anyway, like, long and short of it was, we had one little Boolean setting set the wrong way. It was this thing to do with like how Cassandra bootstraps nodes. So essentially the process is when you add a new node, in each availability zone, it sort of has to redivide out the data and repartition it out and go, great, well, these nodes are responsible for these things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. And if you have this toggle set one way, it ends up where it sort of divides out the data, but doesn't put any of the data on those new nodes. And there's good reasons why that setting exists, but it's not a good one if you don't know exactly how it behaves there. The long and short of this was that we essentially scaled up the cluster. Everything looked healthy on the database. No errors, no warnings, no nothing. Code was mostly performing as is, but we start having really weird stuff happening across the bank. And the reason for that is that these new nodes that we brought up, they were getting queried for data because the sort of the division of like responsibility had happened, but they didn't have the data. So they were like, yep, I should be the person that owns that key or whatever that value is, but I don't, it's empty. And it was just replying like empty things. And so essentially, all over the bank, and because this was a shared piece of infrastructure for all of the different microservices, they all had their own like key spaces, but everything started going very, very weird. And essentially the upshot was like data that should have looked like it existed was just black-holed and completely gone. And so it was very far reaching. It took many hours to get it resolved. We were offline for several hours, which is, you know, the literal worst thing when someone can't pay for certain goods. I mean, we're fortunate that we have some protections in there and we can do some amounts of payments. But yeah, it was a very bad incident. It was messy. It was one of those ones. It was many different teams because it was so far reaching. It was non-engineering teams because we were running our status page to keep people in the loop. We had execs in the room. I remember sitting next to the CEO. He was right beside me. To his credit, he was phenomenal in incidents. He was one of those like, I'm not here to add pressure. I'm sort of here to, so I can osmos and help you folks out. And I remember him sitting beside me and sort of smiling and being like, you know, it's really quite exciting, these incidents, isn't it? And I'm like, not for me, it's not. But it was that was the ethos. Like, it was like, I think it was a very high trust environment where he was essentially like, I can see what's happening here. I'm an engineer myself. I trust the right things are happening. And, you know, it kind of helps. It was like pressure relief kind of thing. So yep, bad incident overall.
Wow. I mean, it's awesome that you had, number one, the support of the CEO. Because like I've been in incidents where leaders they can add pressure and additional emotional labor to something that is already emotionally burdensome. But it must have been a little reassuring for you. Yes, the stress was immense, but at least you didn't have to deal with boss man too. Like he was, hey, this is cool. It's an incident. This is kind of fun. Like that's a really nice thing to have, even though it didn't feel that way at the time.
Yeah, I think it's like I basically I'm acutely aware of like even now at this company where I we're about 100 people at this point, and if there's a bad incident that we have here, I'm sort of acutely aware of my own presence now in the organization. And there's a lot of engineers for whom I could feel very comfortable dropping into an incident and know that I'm going to have very little impact. But as we bring on more and more engineers who don't know me and don't sort of haven't yet onboarded the cultural norms, like the power dynamics are real and they're sort of, it's something to be aware of. But I also the sort of pragmatist in me says that it's possible to establish those quite quickly. So for example, if I was to join an incident here, I think I can quite quickly establish a like, listen, trust everything is happening that's right, that it should be happening. If I can help at all, let me know. Otherwise, I will like, what can I take off your plate? And I think there's things you can do essentially. So yeah, I'm a firm believer in, obviously you need the culture to support it, but having more people, different domains, different disciplines involved in incidents is generally a good thing in my view, as long as you sort of have things set up in such a way to support it.
For sure. I think this is a huge bit of advice and guidance to the leaders and executives that are listening to this episode, that your presence during an incident has an impact, even if you just join a conference bridge or a video chat and you say nothing. There is your presence there has a cognitive and an emotional impact on people in the room. Even if you add nothing to the conversation, it still happens. And so we have to be, as leaders, we have to be mindful and be deliberate about what the impact is. So I think you've articulated that amazingly, and hopefully people learn that, and incident culture benefits globally as a result. So I really appreciate you sharing that. That's cool. That's really huge. Yeah, so in prep for this episode, I did take some time and I read the postmortem for this incident. It's still published on the Monzo website. And I have to say, I've written a lot of postmortems. I've read a lot of postmortems as a SRE ops person. This is probably one of the best written in terms of making the incident understandable. So if I was like a business person, or just some random person that ran into it on Hacker News and read it, I feel that it was way easier for me to comprehend what was going on rather than a lot of incidents I've read, online from other companies. So it looks like you co-authored it. So well done. Did you write the customer facing bit?
Yeah, so essentially Sahail and I, so Sahail is a staff SRE at Monzo, or staff backend engineering might be his title. Honestly, one of the best engineers I've worked with, like just an amazing guy. And he and I essentially, like in the wake of this incident, we spent basically a week like on a whiteboard trying to work out how to articulate the problem really clearly, how to, there were benefits to that postmortem that were internal as much as external. So it was like we had basically, as a platform team, we had sort of, made a change that had caused a pretty significant ripple across all of the teams at Monzo, right? And so I think it was a acknowledgement of that, and it's not sort of like, that we were trying to sort of overly apologize, like these things are going to happen, and no one was sort of holding us and being like, we're so angry at you. But like that postmortem was very intentionally a very big piece of work for us. And so I did most of the writing. Sahel was like super involved in sort of making sure it was accurate. He spent a lot of time explaining things to me. Like I learned a ton about Cassandra from that incident that I didn't know beforehand, which is again one of the beauties of incidents. But yeah, I think it was and it went down really well, which was the thing. I think I would, if I was to like try and get one thing out into the world of like, modern companies, it is you don't have to look bad by sharing like your failures and being public about incidents. And so like sharing on your status page and then sharing postmortems that give a peek behind the curtain. I think there's a way that you can do those that engenders like greater trust versus, you know, people being like, oh, well now I'm really worried because Monzo scaled their database. Like generally the feedback was overwhelmingly positive, but it was a really fun write-up actually. I sort of haven't had, fortunately, like any significant, didn't have any more at Monzo that were of that significance to write about. But yeah, it's something that it's a good thing to do, I think.
For sure. Yeah, it is a cultural shift, right? Around relationship with incidents. Because of course, running production systems, when we do have incidents, you know, we talk about SLO and we're talking about customer expectations and maintaining customer trust and thinking about renewal and all of that. But I think making the investment in postmortem culture, the outcome, and you've touched on it, you can have an incident and it can be an ugly one, but the way that you respond to it and the way that you communicate it to your customers, and it's not just about saying, yes, we are responsible and we're sorry, but actually talking about this is what we've learned from it. These are the process and technology breakdowns. That builds trust. That dialogue builds trust. So you could actually come out of an incident with even higher levels of customer like satisfaction and loyalty than if you didn't have it at all. I'm not saying turn off prod so you can induce that, but I think there's a huge bit of wisdom in there in terms of how you handle incidents and communicate them. That's based on a culture of sharing and openness rather than a culture of fear.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of pragmatic enough to know that there's nuance in this, right? Which is,
yeah,
there are almost certainly some companies where if they shared some things like that, their share price would drop and there's all sorts of impacts there. Like I know that Monzo had a sweet spot with its customer base that were like, generally it was younger, skewed to younger people who are more forgiving and loved the sort of trust and transparency angle. And like, you can imagine a world where, you know, I share that I'm in a stodgy sort of old school bank and I share a similar postmortem and people are like, well, this is nerve wracking that they have their, you know, they're using this database technology or they didn't have more controls in place. So I do appreciate that it's nuanced, but like generally, even if they're writing your postmortems is not for growing trust externally with your customer base, I think the process of writing the postmortem is such a clarifying process for learning and understanding as the person who's sort of there. And if you can write that in such a way that it really is clear and accessible, and accessibility is the key thing. As soon as you lose someone, you know, on the first paragraph and they switch off and they don't read anymore, you've lost all that benefit. So I think if you can write them even internally in such a way that the rest of the org wants to, or a handful of people across your organization want to read it, they get something from it and they're like, that's great, I understand something a little bit deeper now, there's a huge benefit to that. So that's always in the back of my mind when I'm writing a postmortem, is like, is there a small group of people who will be able to read this, be able to understand it, and be able to take that forward and sort of be markedly better or markedly more aware going into the next incident?
Yeah, huge. Organizational learning, absolutely, absolutely important. Because yeah, people from other teams can read your postmortems and learn something.
Yes. And I should say, like, we have a thing actually in Incident IO, without sort of plugging the product too much. It's not really about the product. It's more about the sort of what we're doing is. So we have this like nudge at the end. So we run loads of incidents here. So we have a really low threshold for what we consider an incident in Incident IO. So a customer bumps into a front end bug that means they have to hit the button, save button twice, right? That triggers a sentry. That will be created into an incident immediately. The person who's dealing with sort of reactive work on the team will look at it. They'll figure out whether they can backlog it or need to fix it. And they will sort of dive right into that. And so that you're not going to write a postmortem for every incident of that threshold, right? These are tiny things, transactional, very quick. But we do have this little prompt for lower severity incidents, which is to share incident learnings. And then what happens is people will be like, huh, really interesting quirk of Go here. If you write this thing like this and this and this, it does this and this and this, and you hit share. And then that goes into a channel that we have in Slack called Incident Learnings. And they're all just like 2-3 bullet points of these little nuggets of thing. And like, not everyone is going to read every single one of those, but like I jump in there every now and again and just like, there's little, there's things that fly by and I can in 2 minutes read a few of these things and be like, that's really interesting, I've learned a few things. And it's like, it's a leaky mechanism. It's not going to mean everyone is on the same page, but it means that some people will learn some things and you will develop some level of like organizational knowledge over time that is better than if you didn't.
Wow. I'm going to take that and put it in my pocket for later. Yeah. That's so cool. Cause you're absolutely right. Like reading the entire narrative and every single one from every single incident is really hard, but those little bits of trivia, it's bite-sized. It's easy for people to consume. And your point, like you could just binge read all the interesting 100%. Foibles, right? Like, yeah, that's a great way to have your incident and postmortem culture yield fruit, even if it's little stuff, just getting people to read it and look at some of the interesting tidbits. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that.
No problem.
Okay. So let's pivot a little bit to the main topic of our episode today, the big elephant in the room when it comes to tech in general. You go on LinkedIn, you're going to see posts about it from here until the end of time. You go to Hacker News, you're going to read similar. Of course, we're talking about AI, right? So companies, they're all trying to incorporate it into their products, or they're augmenting how their people do work. Incident.io, of course, is no exception to this rule. But you have a unique philosophy about AI and the automation of manual effort, toil, right? So recently you published an article called Avoiding the Ironies of Automation, and you discuss in detail how automation can go really, really wrong. So mind sharing with our listeners the key points, your philosophy on this subject?
Yes, it's a big subject. And I should say, like, my philosophy is evolving all the time with, like, when I see more and more things that are capable, which is super fun. Like, I don't think I've been, you know, having worked in technology for however long now, I think this is the time where everything is like day to day. I'm like, oh my gosh, like my views have changed a little since yesterday. But generally, the post I wrote about avoiding the ironies of automation. So I guess like the ironies of automation was a paper by Lizanne Bainbridge. And essentially it sort of outlines this kind of paradoxical nature of automation, which is that, you know, the more automation you introduce to sort of take the manual work off the plate of humans, sort of objectively sounds sensible and sounds very good. The more you do that, the more the kind of the skills of the humans atrophy. And so it's sort of like the paper goes into some of the sort of mechanical applications. So you imagine a factory that's producing something and it's mostly by hand and right, it's by skill, or it's an operator pulling the levers of the machine. And if something goes wrong, the operator goes, right, well, it's this process here that I need to now go and do something with, whatever else. Now, if you imagine you automate that process and now the human is not really involved, they're sort of monitoring this automated machine producing widgets. When that goes wrong, they're like, well, I have no context. My abstraction level of operating things is up here and this is machine is now, you know, elsewhere. And so like it basically, you know, in a world of AI, and this sort of paper was sort of specifically talking about, you know, in the context of us with like using AI to help you resolve incidents, there's a sort of, you know, if AI, the more AI takes off our plates, right? If you assume that at some point it's going to hit a limit or it's going to fail or something will go wrong, if a human has to then step in and take over, like they're at, but it's sort of excluded from all of the sort of the lower level work up until that point, it's like you're dropped into a much worse situation, right? Because you've had a bunch of automations run, all things are going on, and you haven't had the sort of previous time to sort of get the practice and sort of get the reps in of doing that kind of stuff. And so that was really what it was about. In terms of like my viewpoints on sort of how I think we avoid this, I think this is going to change this viewpoint as things evolve, right? Because AI is becoming more and more competent, and I'm sort of over time becoming, the more I see what we're able to build here, the more sort of confidence and conviction I have that in fact, in future, there will be many more things we can take off the plate of humans. Mm-hmm. But broadly, like the way we see things right now is that there are a whole bunch of things that AI is very, very competent at doing and doing safely. So mm-hmm. for example, going and doing research, an incident kicks off, you have an alert, being able to go and say, right, well, what do we know about that alert? Is there is there metadata in there that we can extract and learn something from? And it's like, great, well, now we have that. What else might we want to go and look at to corroborate or, you know, prove wrong that kind of a hypothesis that we might have formed? So we might look at dashboards. Sure. which we browse like a human. So we look at it pictorially, which is really interesting. We then also look at your past incidents, because there's an enormous amount of knowledge encoded in past incidents. We also look at what changes have gone to production. A lot, very commonly, incidents are caused by something going wrong, you know, being changed. And so we do all of that, and then we bring that together and we form a hypothesis, and we go, have we got enough information now to be able to do things? And we sort of go through the many different loops, and essentially we then come back and we go, here's what we think is going on. Here is what we think is the probable cause of the sort of, you know, the thing that you need to be paying attention to. And here's what we suggest you do next. And that was where we, when I wrote the paper, that was where we were at with that product. And we were like, great. Sure. So we sort of can steer a human in the direction. And so you have this kind of cooperative agent-like system where it's doing some work for you, and it comes back and goes, hey, I've got this thing. And you can go, no, I have some more information for you. It's not that, it's this. And it will go and do some more work and come back. And in the meantime, you're doing it in parallel. And so it's sort of like work together. And in that world, you sort of avoid this like ironies of automation, because it's not really automating things. It's like an assistant working with you. It's very similar in sort of its way it works to like a, you know, working with another human. It kind of strengthens your understanding of things. Now, the interesting thing is over time, we've gotten deeper down the rabbit hole, and we're like, actually, do you know what? Given that we know this information, we have all of this together, we can actually do things like propose code changes now. So we can come back and not just go, hey, go and look at this thing. But it's like, hey, we've just opened a pull request. All of the checks on GitHub and CI are already running. You should go check that. And if you're happy, hit merge. And you know, you can see how that takes probably, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes out of an incident's time. And we're not going to get it right all the time, but there's a human in the loop and it's default safe. Other things we can do now are, you know, well, maybe a common thing you're going to do is after you've investigated, you maybe there's a customer impact and you want to send some comms to them. And we can prepare those and go, hey, here's some pre-canned, really nicely written, highly contextual, but abstracted at the right level, comms for that customer or a status page update. And so we're increasingly taking, I think, more of the work off the plate. But now I think we're in a world though where humans are sort of necessary in the loop. I think you know the way we broadly think about this is there's a few axes. There's like trust. It's like, do I trust that a system can take on all the responsibilities of a human? Obviously not. Do I trust it can take on a subset? I'm like, yes, but I still want a human probably in the loop. I think the next iteration is like, I trust it to take a subset of actions without me, and the rest of them I want to be in the loop. But longer term, I think there is a strong likelihood that essentially we will end up with, you know, operational systems that will be able to handle a vast majority of those things. And I think that's where actually my thinking on the avoiding the errors or automation kind of breaks down a little bit, because I think if you get to that point, humans are going to be less involved. And I think there's a whole bunch of strategies we have and plans we have to try and stop that, like making sure that systems are not black boxes that you can't peer inside. And they're very like clear about, here is the steps I took, here's why I've done it, you know? And it's like, so even if it gets to the wrong answer, if it's got to the wrong answer through the right set of steps and you can sort of rationalize why, you're like, great, okay, I understand and I've learned and I can sort of figure stuff out. But as I said, super dynamic, who knows how it's gonna go?
Yeah, I appreciate you walking through all of the thoughts you had to come to this conclusion. So if we take a step back, there was actually an article published a while back when like SRE was new for us, at least. And Tom Limoncelli, he was a former Google SRE, and he wrote some books like The Practice of Cloud System Administration. He co-authored that, Time Management for System, and, you know, so he was doing his thing back then. He discussed these two principles that really jumped out at me when it came to your article, and it was principles around automation. So you had the leftover principle. So we could start there. Leftover principle: automate away everything that you can, right, and leave everything else for the humans to do. Mm-hmm. So you end up with some problems. One of the problems is the one that you mentioned. You're making the technical details of your system and how it's operated and how it's built opaque. So now we cognitively as engineers have lost something, which is that context.
Yep.
That's one problem. The second problem with the leftover principle is that all of the work that is left for us to do, leftover principle, is the really, really, really hard stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. So what the impact is, we have to hire more specialist engineers to solve the classes of problems that are then left behind. So that's the big issue. Now, the vision that you're speaking to, which is this idea of, I am operating in collaboration with automation or agent. It doesn't matter what the implementation is, but we're talking about the compensatory principle, which is you are working in tandem with software or automation in that we are leaving software to do what it's really good at. In your example, we are talking about summarization of text, using past data and time series, using past examples of comms, you know, so on and so forth. Those are things that are really good that the AI can do. But at the end of the day, leaving the human being to observe and say, yeah, this makes sense, do it, is a good partnership between man and machine, in that you can't hold, what's the IBM quote? You can't hold a machine responsible for business decisions. So you don't put a machine in charge of business decisions. So that was like the first thing I thought about when I read your article, and I thought it was so compelling. And it's good to remember these ideas and be thoughtful about how we automate our tasks away, especially incident management.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I sort of ruminate on this quite a lot, right? Because, you know, it's hyper relevant to what we're doing. I think an interesting kind of thought experiment is there are already huge amounts of atrophied skills in software engineering and technology generally, right? So like, if I was to ask you, like, how does a register work inside of a machine specifically when, you know, when you're having an incident, you're like, well, I don't have to care about that because, you know, someone's written hardware and it does that stuff. And you're like, cool. But that, maybe that's academic. So you go, okay, cool. Well, if you're running Kubernetes, like, how much do you know specifically about how to place a piece of software on a particular EC2 instance that's running underneath your Kubernetes cluster? And I'm like, I don't. I just know that if a node dies, Kubernetes is software and it will move things and displace them elsewhere. And so I don't do any cooperative work with Kubernetes at all. I trust that it works. And I think you're right that you still get hard stuff left, right? Because if Kubernetes breaks, someone needs to understand how Kubernetes works at the end of the day. And so you have this, but essentially what you're doing is somewhere there is a line that you don't understand what's below that line. And the things that are above that line are the things you have to understand to be able to manage the stuff that's below the line, if you're keeping up with that. And I think it is just a case of, like, if you know, the more that you push below the line, the more time and sort of brain power and capacity you give to humans to focus on learning how to do the things that are above the line. So we're all really good now as, like, platform people are operating Kubernetes because we don't have to care about a bunch of stuff, like, from registers and bits all the way up to containers on nodes. Like, and I think if you sort of extrapolate from that point of view, you go, great, well, what if incident management software in 10 years time is doing the equivalent to generalized running software as Kubernetes is doing to running containers on nodes? And in that world, you essentially go, I have this machine that can sort of take control of a bunch of different operational activities for me, and I trust it to do them all. And if it breaks, I'm going to need humans. And I think humans will always, always be necessary, because if you sort of buy into the fact that incidents are fundamentally what happens when all of the planned controls, all of the work that you've thought about ahead of time have failed, then you will always hit that limit. And it will just be a different level of abstraction that we get to. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's honestly very hard to predict how it will play out, what the sort of dynamics will look like for humans involved in technology and what they'll do. But I think there's a lot of people who are very nervous about it. I am not nervous. I'm just eager to see how it all plays out. I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and I think there'll be risks that get introduced. I think there'll be incredible advances that are made, and I think I don't foresee that we are going to be in a worse place in 5 years than we are now. I think we'll be in a markedly better place where being able to create value for people and for businesses to create value will be faster, and there'll be better systems to compensate for the risks that are introduced by doing things faster with more vibe coding and all the other kind of things that go on there.
Yeah, I appreciate your optimism. And I think that optimism is well founded, so long as, here's the condition, that we being platform engineering people, SREs, DevOps practitioners, we are speaking for the trees, as in we have a software system and it needs to behave in a certain way, it needs to be available, it needs to be tested, and that we are actively monitoring and understanding and responding to when things go wrong, rather than, to your point, it's a black box, it works, I throw my inputs at it, I get my outputs, I pass it to the user. So there needs to be some discipline, engineering discipline, involved in including this newfangled tech into our stacks. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Yeah. I think I agree. I think we're talking time horizons, right? Because I could ask pretty much any engineer here, like, how, you know, an alpha particle strike affects a piece of hardware or the CPU or whatever else it is, and they'd be like, I have literally no idea. I can't observe my hardware, and it's because that has been established as a thing that is like a solved problem. And I'm not suggesting we'll get to that level with like operating systems in the next 5, maybe even 10 years. But I think we will get to that world, and it's not one where it's all dangerous because we can't observe the systems anymore. It's one where we have sufficient controls on top of those systems that we don't need to anymore. But yeah, as I said, this is all like timelines is the big thing, which people get hung up on because they get very nervous because they're like, is this next year? But I can't imagine a world where I don't have, you know, Honeycomb or Datadog or whatever else it is observing my systems. I'm like, no, nor can I. But like, I think there's a world where that does come one day, and there's some other mechanism we use to sort of operate and manage systems.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. So on the time horizon for incident IO, or just like the future of incident management or the future of on call, do you have like a vision or a unified theory of how you want the on call experience to be? Is it just total removal? I think we're both agreeing that that's almost impossible, but like, what could it look like? What's the vision here?
Yeah, I think we're advancing like on all these different fronts, right? So we want to make on-call much better, because there's an enormous amount of like gas in the tank there around like, how do you make the life of an on-call person better? So there's a bunch of human level things, which is just like, How do we do all the rough edges that we have to deal with the current on-call systems? How do we make those much smoother and nicer, so you can trade shifts and you can get, you know, all the sort of the good bits there? But there's also things there where you can start to go, well, what about a world where there's something that exists between an alert coming in and my phone making a loud noise at 2 a.m. that tries to do some form of triage of that thing? And if it can understand the alert and it can go, hey, listen, the last, you know, 80 times this thing fired, it was a no op, or I've done an investigation based on this alert, I've done what you would have done, which is look at the dashboard, and it's just a spike. It's a transient spike. It doesn't need looking at now. Everything's back. System looks normal. And it's sort of intercepting that. And you can imagine a world where, rather than engineers being woken up many times a night, or, you know, whenever it might be, you can reduce the noise there. Like, it's a huge problem we hear from our customers. Probably one of the single most consistent problems we hear is people going, I had last quarter 10,000 alerts, and, you know, that all of those are adding up to a loss of productivity because my engineers are more tired, or, you know, distractions and focus being lost, all those sorts of things. So I think there's a whole bunch of things we will get to in on-call. On the response side of the world, which is like generally how do you respond to incidents, like, again, I think there is a world where AI plays into that, but there's also just like really important things that we can do to help make, you know, companies who have to like report incidents much easier. It's like, how do we take the sting out of all of that kind of stuff? And I don't know, there's a ton going on. Customer comms as well. There's so many different things that we can do there. We're a company that has far too many ideas for the number of people that we have working on them at the moment. So we are rapidly trying to ramp up our engineering team to get through them all.
Yeah. That being said, I think you did speak to one of the biggest tasks involved in handling alerts, much less incidents. It's that initial triage. Mm-hmm. You know, I get paged, I get out of bed at 2 a.m., I'm looking at the dashboard, I'm looking at the logs, and I am trying to determine whether or not this thing is an actual emergency, and am I the person that is most equipped to solve the problem? If you're able to take all of those heuristics and put them into some kind of agent and have it do a first pass, then that means that all of the engineers that are in the on-call rotation have been moved from level one to level two. They're now an escalation path. They're not the initial responder. I would love that vision. That sounds like a really great place for us to go, even if that was the one thing that changed.
I think that is the perfect articulation of the kind of thing I think we will do. And it's, I mean, it's not without risk, right? Because the second you put a machine on level one, you're essentially handing over a degree of like decision making to a machine to make a thing there. So like, I'm super yes. cognizant of that. But there's worlds where you could have safety mechanisms in there, right? Which is like, hey, these are the dashboards and the metrics and the things you should be checking, you know, and if they don't return to green after X amount of time, auto escalate to the person, or, you know, there's all sorts of interesting things you could do there. But all of them, I think this is the thing, all of them introduce some amount of risk, but all of them also introduce a large amount of opportunity. And the world that we're in right now is also not one without risk. So if engineers are on level one and they're being spammed by alerts, you can guarantee there are some alerts that they aren't even investigating at all, and they're ignoring, and they're like, this is probably just noise. And so I think your articulation is perfect, which is just like, you know, imagine a machine being level one escalation, and you get escalated to for a smaller subset of those things.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, it looks like we're coming up on time. I would love to attend SevZero again. When is it going to be held this year? Where and when?
That is a really, really great question. So we're this year going to be in San Francisco and London. So we're doing it as two separate conferences this time. It's in San Francisco, September 23rd, and it is in London the month after October 23rd. It's also free. It's got some incredible speakers. So like last year we had OpenAI, Netflix, we had Slack, we had a bunch of like absolutely incredible speakers. And there's going to be a similar lineup this year. So yeah, excited to get into it.
Awesome. Yeah. Highly recommend listeners check the SevZero conference out. I went last year. I had a great time. Met some really interesting folks, including this gentleman. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Reliability Rebels and talking to us about incident response and automation and AI. This was a very engaging conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Reliability Rebels. Until next time.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check.
Reliability Rebels.